I have a letter in my files which begins this way. Dear Rabbi, when I die, I want you to promise me that at my funeral you won't read that bit about a woman of valor. That traditional evocation of the ideal wife, mother, was over the long history of our people the favorite reading of all, as a eulogy for one who deserved it. So much was it beloved that the custom developed in Eastern Europe that on the Sabbath eve, the dinner table, the sons and daughters, the husband would recite the Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor, the poem about the capable woman in love, recite it to the mother. What was spoken in love was accepted in love. But for the modern woman, this traditional praise is somehow not quite apposite, accurate. For its lines describe a woman who fulfills herself through her children and through her husband. Her drive, her need is not for an identity of her own. To fulfill herself is a separate person. Rather, her goal has been to be the heart of a family, to be the pulse which throws out the energy and keeps the ties of family, the ties of the children of the generations together. To educate, to encourage, to love, to care. Now, from a purely literary point of view, we would describe this portion of the Book of Proverbs as an acrostic poem, which is to say that every succeeding verse begins with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The effect of the poem is not one in which there is progression of thought. It depends rather on an accumulation of loving descriptions of the idealized wife and mother of a Judean family in the 5th-4th century before the Common Era. It is modern, I suspect, only in this, and this is important. The woman who is loved, who is spoken of, is not described as an object. She is not an exotic. She is not on a pedestal. She is loved for herself. She is judged by her actions. She is seen as a human being. And in that sense, she fits one of the basic needs of even of women's liberation today. She's a mother and not a sex object. Let me read to you a modern translation of this poem. A capable wife is a rare find. Her worth is far greater than jewelry. Her husband gives her his confidence, and he is well compensated for it. She rewards him with good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks out wool and flask, and she delights to work with her hands. She is like the ships of the merchants as she brings her provisions from afar. She rises while it is still night to provide food for her household and to give instruction to her maids. She examines a field and buys it. From her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She girds her strong loins and goes to work with a will. She samples merchandise to make sure it is good. Her lamp burns late at night. She puts her hand to the spindle whorl, and her fingers ply the spindle. She opens her hands to the unfortunate. She stretches out her arms to the poor. She does not fear for her family when it snows, for all of them are doubly clothed. She makes her own bed covers. She clothes herself in fine linen and dyed wool. Her husband is well known at the gates where he sits with the elders of the city. She makes a wrapper and sells it and supplies a sash to the merchants. Her clothing is of good quality and elegant. She happily looks forward to the morrow. When she opens her mouth, she speaks wisely and kindly instruction is on her tongue. She watches closely what goes on in her household and permits no one to eat food in idleness. Her sons rise to pronounce blessings on her. Her husband, too, sings her praises. Many women have proved their worth, but you have surpassed them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is fleeting. The intelligent woman who reveres God is the one deserving of praise. Give her the reward she has earned, and let the gates ring with praises of her deeds. Now this is quite moving. Eulogy, praise of a woman of Judea so many centuries ago, occupies the very last place in the biblical book of Proverbs. It was obviously originally an independent poem. An editor decided it was a fit climax or fit conclusion, ending, to this book of wisdom, school marmy, school mastery advice, prudential wisdom, set down for the benefit of the sons and the young men of that time, so that they would know how to live and how to guide themselves and how to be prudent and cautious and successful in all that they did. And the question is why someone should have selected this particular poem and added on to the book. And the answer would seem to be that the editor felt a need to counterbalance another image of woman, one which appears throughout the book of Proverbs. The woman that schoolmasters warn schoolboys about when they're 16 and 17 and 18, the woman of the streets, the woman who paints her face and perfumes her body, who is an allurement, an enticement, the temptress, the woman who will lead the young man away from the straight and narrow, from his duties, his schoolwork, his responsibilities, and lead him down the primrose path, wherever that path goes. Let me read you another poem, not as well known, never read at a funeral as far as I know, which has to do with this woman, the temptress. It's the seventh chapter of the book of Proverbs. My son, guard my words and treasure my instructions. Keep my instructions if you would find life. Bind them on your fingers and scribe them on the tablet of your mind to guard you from the adulteress, from the stranger woman, with her seductive words. For as I have gazed from the window of my house and looked down from my lattice, watching the fools below, I observed among them a silly youth passing by on the street near her corner, strolling in the direction of her house. In the dusk, when evening was coming on, when the time for sleep comes with the darkness, see, a woman comes to meet him, dressed up as a prostitute, and heavily veiled, boisterous and bold, never at home. Now in the street, now in the square, looking at every corner, she catches hold of him and kisses him, and with brazen face says to him, I have sacrificial meat on hand, for today I discharge my religious vows. That is why I have come out to meet you. I was looking for you, and I have found you. I have spread coverlets on my couch of gaily colored linen from Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come. Let us drink deep of love. Till the morning, let us revel in lovemaking. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a distant journey. He has taken the money bag with him. He will not be home until the full moon. So she sways him with her many allurements, and by her smooth words, she persuades him. All at once, he is walking with her like an ox being led to the slaughter, like a stag prancing into captivity. Till an arrow pierces its heart like a bird darting into a snare, not knowing its life is in danger. So now, my son, listen to me and pay attention to what I say. Do not toy with the thoughts of meeting her. Do not stray into her paths, for she has felled many victims. Numberless are those she has slain. Her house is the way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. These two images, the image of woman as home, homemaker, home body, the image of woman as temptress, as the woman of the street, the woman of allurements, the woman of the harem and the seraglio. These two images appear and reappear, infect and reinfect all of Jewish thought in biblical and post-biblical times. And somehow, as I gather with so many other literatures of the past, our ancestors tend to feel that women were divided by race, that there were good women, women who were human, women whom you took to heart and reverenced, and then there were the others, the alien woman, the stranger woman, the animal-like woman, those beware. And of course, I suppose, each had its own attraction. Now, the image of the woman as man's companion, beloved, respected, appears at the very beginning of the biblical story. God says that it is not meet that man should live alone. I will make him an Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate for himself. And man, Adam, after Eve has been created, says, she shall be bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Like man, woman is created in the image of God. And as much as, and perhaps more than almost any other literature of the time, the biblical literature shows that our people strove for a respect, a courtesy towards the woman, unrivaled at the time. In most of the martial codes of the ancient times, the Code of Hammurabi, the Code of Lipit Ishtar, and others, you find respect demanded of the young man, of the military hero. Vassal must respect the Lord. In the Bible, we find Kaved et avicha v'et imecha, respect both your father and your mother. And the respect that was due to the woman is codified in law. Thus, as when in several of the West Asian codes, there is a separate listing of the compensation that's to be paid if you injure the body of a man, and it's that much more than if you, by chance, accidentally injure a woman. According to the biblical code, the compensation to be paid for accidental injury done to a woman is identical with that which is to be paid for injury done to a man. And the rabbinic tradition picks up and reinforces this biblical tradition. The sages said that one is not only to stand up and to pay one's respect to one's father, but when one's mother enters the room, one is to stand up and to pay similar respect. Love your wife as yourself and honor her more than yourself. Why did God make woman? Because God discovered he could not be everywhere. If a man divorces the wife of his youth, even the altar of God weeps. And I could multiply these examples endlessly. And so you find in our tradition, rather remarkably, a respect for the honorable woman, the good woman, the woman whom you take into yourself, and she is respected, interestingly, not only for her life within the home, but she is respected for what she can do in the store, in business, buying a field, managing the fields. Throughout our tradition, women were accepted in the marketplace, encouraged often to do what needed to be done, particularly if the husband died and the widow had to carry on. And right down through our history, you can list women who had positions of responsibility outside the home, and who were respected for it. Miriam, the sister of Moses, a prophet. Deborah, the 12th century judge who rallied all of the tribes of Israel against the Elamite enemy. Huldah, the prophetess of Judea, to whom King Josiah brought the newly discovered Deuteronomic scroll for validation. Athaliah, a queen of ancient Israel who ruled in her own right. Salome Alexandra, the Hasmonean queen who ruled by herself and was accepted as queen. Beruria, the scholarly wife of Rabbi Meir in Mishnaic times, whose wisdom was consulted even by the greatest scholars of his day. The daughter of a Gaon, Samuel ben Ali, who was so famous for her Talmudic learning that all of his academy moved to her house to learn from her when her father died and could teach obviously no more. And in Europe, the responsive literature indicates to us that it was common for women to own real estate, to deal in property, to run a store, to manage the family business, to give large sums of money of their own to charity. Our tradition for these honorable women was one which was prepared to respect them and to acknowledge them. Our tradition was not one which saw women as a subspecies who, if they proved bulky or recalcitrant, could be driven to the job, you know, by wife beating. Wife beating is the most common of phenomenon in most medieval and ancient societies. But if a Jewish husband was accused by his wife of having beaten her, he was to be brought to the courts, and if he refused to stop, he was to be beaten publicly himself, and if he still refused to stop, a divorce was to be granted her, and he was to be excommunicated. You can find, in other words, in our tradition, a long, rather noble history, particularly one which is noble in comparison with its times, situation, of respect for womankind, and a willingness to see them as human beings, as people, capacity, and of ability. And you will also find in our tradition the woman who is the creation of the libido of the man, the very beginning again of the tradition. Eve is the temptress. It is she who leads Adam to eat from the forbidden fruit. And there is the woman of the streets, the adulterous woman in the book of Proverbs. And of course, the more repression, the more the sexual image appears even in the religious theology. The Song of Songs was translated into a real sexual image of God's relationship to man and man's to God's. The libido played tricks on many of these people, particularly in rabbinic times, particularly in those eras after that strange amalgam of thought, which is that of Christianity and Greek wisdom, which led to a feeling that the flesh was somehow evil, that all the passions of the flesh must be burnt out, that there was nothing normal and natural and holy in the husband-wife relationship, which was one that must not only be for procreation, but to give pleasure each to the other. And as that tradition began to envelop the Christian world, the Muslim world, its shadow fell deeply over the Jewish world. And you find in the tradition phrases that one who speaks endlessly with a woman inevitably is led into sin. You find the tradition which forces the woman upon her marriage to shave off her hair, lest she become an allurement to some other man. Never the man shaving off his hair, lest he be an allurement to some woman. Always the woman wearing the shtreimel. And then you get to the point in some of the traditions, Hasidic, Kabbalistic, where the Rebbe will not even look at a woman if she comes into the room to ask him a question. He'll turn his back and speak to her with his voice, you know, reverberating off the wall. A testimony, if testimony there ever be, of the the power of the imagination. His mind must not be taken from the holy thoughts, and the very presence of a woman would somehow do it. Those are the two traditions which you find interwoven, interlaced in what we call Judaism. But if you want to understand the Jewish attitude towards woman, you must also understand the law and the custom around which Jewish life organized itself. And it is here, more than in these two rather natural attitudes, that you find the specific problems which women's liberation, equality movement must wrestle with today when it comes to grips with the Jewish tradition, the rabbinic tradition, which is, when all is said and done, male and chauvinist, but since it's Jewish, it can't be a pig. There were many women in biblical days who had roles of authority, roles of responsibility. There were many women, apparently, during the First Temple who were able to come and take part in whatever worship occurred there. But when the Second Temple was built, built by Judeans, be it remembered, who came back from the Persian exile, where there were laws in the Zoroastrian tradition which widely separated and segregated the sexes. When they came back, the distance between men and women in the service, in the cult, was emphasized. The women could not go beyond Nicanor's gate, enter into the inner courts of the temple. And whereas there had been prophetesses in early times, and the fact that the priesthood was all male, there was a high priest but no high priestess, in exilic times, post-exilic times, the maleness of the priesthood, the maleness of the Levites, the gate beyond which women could not come, the fact that all of the rules of the Bible are phrased in the second person masculine, which means that since Hebrew is a language where verbs and nouns take the case endings as well as the pronouns, the law seems to relate specifically to men. During Second Temple times, women were gradually separated out from attendance at, and certainly from participation in, the central rites of the cult. The law, for instance, requires that three times each year the Judeans should congregate in Jerusalem to take part in the great pilgrimage festivals of Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. The law is written in the second person plural masculine. So men are obliged. There was no rule in Second Temple times that women may not come, but the men were obliged to come. And what becomes obligatory is what is obviously the most important. And when the synagogue evolved from the temple, after the destruction of the temple, it maintained the masculinity, the distance between the sexes which had grown up in Second Temple times. Women were kept in the small synagogues of ancient Palestine on the portico, or if it was a two-story building, in the balcony. Now, there is no rule in law, Jewish law, that a woman may not read from the Sefer Torah at public worship. But it so happened that they did not. There is no rule in traditional Jewish law that a woman may not put on tallis and tefillin, but they simply did not. They were separated out by custom, by male conspiracy, perhaps conscious or unconscious. They were separated out from the major activities of the ritual. All those positive commandments which have a specific time associated with them. And gradually, the world closest to God, the world of the synagogue, which became also the world of study, was by custom, though not necessarily by traditional law, closed off to them. And so, though there is no rule that a woman may not study Torah and may not study Talmud and become a great scholar, the Jews simply created a universal male school system. Girls didn't go to cheder, and they didn't go to the yeshiva. Many studied, Some learnt a great deal, some became great scholars. But the emphasis was on the learning of the man, not the mastery of the tradition by the woman. The woman's role was biologically and sociologically accepted as private, the home. If not the home, then at least the home, the farm, the business. Those worlds were, she was encouraged to enter, but not this very private world of the Talmudic school and of the synagogue. And since the synagogue world was also the judicial world of the Jewish community, laws which appear in very simplistic forms, simple forms in the Bible, were reinforced to the detriment of women. The Bible says a man may present his wife a bill of divorcement. Doesn't it also say a woman may present a man a bill of divorcement? And so the law became ramified that a man could for any reason divorce his wife, but a woman couldn't force a no good husband to divorce her. And if you read the response of literature, you discover any number of cases throughout history where a woman wanted to get rid of a man for very good reason. And she was not able to do so until she paid him some horrible ransom in order to give her the right to what should have been hers by right. A woman was not accepted as a witness in a trial, except in very rare occasions, on no better grounds than that the Bible had used the male plural edim, witnesses, as opposed to some female gender ending, edot. And the rabbis controlled the courts, and simply they said a woman like fools and like others should not, children should not be allowed or trusted to bring witness. Now these kinds of restrictions, plus the limitation of the synagogue, the holy place, to a male-dominated social order, plus one major ritual taboo, that of nida, that of the rich laws of ritual purity which apply to menstruation. These rules succeeded in de facto creating a separate world for women to a large degree apart from the world of men. There have been all kinds of ritual laws, purity laws in biblical times. The priests, the Levites, those who brought tithes to the temple, those who came on pilgrimages to the temple, all could attract certain kinds of impurities to themselves. These are simply ritual taboos, and they retained these ritual impurities until they went to a mikveh, they bathed, they were cleansed by act of them. With the destruction of the temple, all the other ritual taboos, save those which applied to women, dropped aside. And now women were somehow singled out. They saw themselves as impure for part of each month, and that which they touched was somehow ritually impure. And this old law began to become one which was terribly tied into the awareness of the woman of the dignity of her own person, her sense of worth. And finally, there is that infamous first blessing of the morning, one of the 100 blessings which a traditional Jew recited every morning. Praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman. Now, it's not quite what it seems. It does not assume that women are of a different kind of species. Rabbi Judah ben Eli, who lived at about the time this particular blessing was introduced into the liturgy, says, the reason for this is simply this, that a woman is not obliged to fulfill as many of the commandments as a man. We are blessed because we have a greater duty than does the woman. Now, whatever explanation, virtue that explanation has, the prayer remains an unrivaled example of male arrogance, and one which I suspect sustained Jewish men each morning for all the confrontations they would have with their wives all day long. During the long period which we call rabbinic, from the first century to the emancipation. The sense of distance, the psychological sense of space between the men and the women, instead of diminishing, grew. And when Judaism broke out of the ghetto, when liberal Judaism began to emerge, it's fascinating that the very first thing that was demanded by men and by women was the mixed pew, men and women sitting together. No more Weiberschule, no more women in the balcony, but families seated together at public worship. And the very first creation of liberal Judaism was what we call confirmation. It's a terrible word. It assumes that somehow a child at a particular period, 14, 15, 16, becomes Jewish. But actually, confirmation is a first step in recreating or in creating a Judaism in which women and men occupy an equal role. What does it say? It says there is now a universal educational system for men and for women, for young men and for young women. And we are not going to create a pale version of the male rite of passage, the bar mitzvah. We're going to create something new, something which says that in all ways, young men and young women are equal before the law. Confirmation was the very first creative act by liberal Judaism. And the emancipation of women has been the most conspicuous triumph, and I suspect the only truly lasting triumph of the liberal movement. It's irreversible. Women were called to the Torah. Women read the service. Women counted for a minyan. Women became cantors. Women became members of boards of congregations. Women became presidents of boards of congregations. Women became rabbis. And little by little, rather quickly over the long history, if you look at over a long period of time, we have created a religious structure in which in all things, men and women are equal as they should be and are before God. Now, where does Judaism stand today? The liberal movement stands ready to receive as many women into the rabbinate as will prepare themselves. I think that we have really managed, by and large, to clear away the debris of the past, the separations of the past. We're now trying to move, I'm trying to move, this congregation is trying to move in the direction of finding activities, daytime and nighttime, which are not sociologically designated women, day, men, night, as though the old work divisions are still complete, with the women being free during the day and the men at work during the day, and only the men being free from their occupations at night. We've moved into a new arena of concern, but the major battle for equality before God, equality in the synagogue, has been won. The conservative movement is moving the same direction, but of course much slower. That's just by its very nature. You may have seen the last several months their rabbinic conference and conference of congregations finally said a woman can be counted for a minyan. We counted women for minyans 150, 170 years ago. And we said the laws of Kaddish are as obligatory on men as on women 150 years ago. But they're moving in the same direction. It's only a matter of time. The Orthodox movement is moving in the other direction, as fast as it can go, in largest part because it sees what we are doing. It is creating a psychology, a cultural apologetic for the segregation and separation of the sexes, which is really quite casuistic and quite effective if you want to believe that a woman's role is that of homemaker, child rearer, and it ought to end there. If you're frightened by the modern woman, by what can happen to a woman in a free society, they have all the answers. The Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor, that's what she should be, and we will see to it that she should be. You'll find in Cleveland Orthodox congregations which 25 years ago took off the mechitza, the fence, the separation between men and women who are now reimposing on. as the right wing of orthodoxy becomes more and more strident and more demanding. And in Israel, you find an interesting phenomenon. Israel, of course, is a classic example of a community which was organized, of a nation which was organized on the basis of the complete political, social emancipation of women, their complete equality. Men and women serve in the armed forces. Over the last 15 years, particularly in the last 10, the Orthodox powers have managed to find ways to get their girls excluded from the armed forces on the grounds that this isn't a fitting occupation for girls of their attitude. They're being trained for responsibilities others than those of the capable woman, the Eshet Chayil, which they hold most precious. Israel suggests the future and the problem. Israel was created, as you know, by numbers of Jews who came largely from Eastern Europe, who came largely bearing a socialist ideology, which insisted from the very beginning on the complete occupational, social, and political equality of men and women. As early as 1920, when they first held local elections in the Yishuv, women were given the vote. Women were given the right to hold office. In the Palmach and its predecessors, the self-defense armies of the Yishuv, women served and held guns and served in the front lines just as men did. In the kibbutzim, in the moshavot, in the early communities, the work schedule was made out without reference to the sex of the person. It was a question of age and strength, not of sex. And as the Israeli community developed, all those institutions of child care, all those legal institutions which guarantee, you know, equal pay for equal work, pregnancy leave, all those institutions would make it possible for women to occupy a complete, full place in the social order. These were established on the basis of law, even to the point that it is a basic law of the State of Israel that the courts must dispense law equally, even if all the parties before the courts come to them from a Muslim or traditional community which says we accept certain kinds of legal distinctions. On the secular side, Israel was established on the basis of complete equality. But if you read the Israeli press, as I do, you will have read in the last 5 or 10 years an interesting series of articles, mostly by women, mostly under titles such as this, The Flight from Feminism. What's happened to women's rights in Israel? There is no claim in any of these articles that there's been a male underground plot to undo the hard-won rights of women. But some interesting facts have emerged. Less women are occupied full-time in Israel than in the United States, proportionately. There were 10 women in the first Knesset. There are only 8 in the present Knesset. The number of women holding office in the local communities has dropped by one half. The number of women proportionate to the total population going on to college has dropped by some one quarter. In a society which establishes by law and which provides some of the ancillary institutions which make it possible for a woman to work full time, something has happened. Women themselves are pulling back from the man's world. A major part of the explanation lies in the peculiar coloration of the new immigrants to Israel over the last 20 years. They're mostly Oriental Jews, Jews who come in from a background which knew the polygamous social order sometimes, knew male autocracy in the home, to whom ideas such as equality of rights are strange and unfamiliar ones. But even considering this, if one looks only at the kibbutzim, if we look only at the grandchildren of the first immigrants, one finds that they have turned away from the the complete equality, the lack of femininity, the desire to enter fully into the masculine society which characterized the generation of Golda, and they've struck out for some other blend. And when they're interviewed, the answers are interesting. I grew up, one said, I remember reading, I grew up in a kibbutz. And I looked at the people who worked in the fields and in the barns and in the factory, and all the women who were over 30 looked as if they were over 60. And I want to keep my man. And so you find in Israel, much to the chagrin of feminists, a resurgence of Miss Israel contests and Mrs. Israel contests. And among the most attractive and expensive goods in Israel are those which are the cosmetics. And the image of the Women's Army Corps is of the beauteous soldier, rather simply than of the woman who is or happens to be a soldier. You find in Israel all kinds of courses in home making, in the arts of being a housewife. When Israeli television opened up, the most popular fare were some of those terrible serials which all of the housewives watch endlessly, I am told, here in these United States. Now, what's happening? Obviously, there's something more desirable for women, and I suspect for many men, than entering the man's world. It's a tough world, it's a lonely world, it's a world which can give you ulcers and high blood pressure. It's a world of sometimes terrifying responsibility. It's a world in which you often have to train yourself not only to be aggressive, but to a certain degree to be insensitive and to be callous. It's a world in which you find yourself saying things that you would rather not be saying, playing up to people that you would rather not be friendly with. The image of a woman as something more than a sex object is, or something more than a man is an image which has not yet been clearly formed. What is a woman's role? What is a woman's right? Our fathers had a very clear, beautiful image, that of the Eshet Chayil, the capable woman. Our daughters and our wives do not have such a clear image. They know what's wrong, but not necessarily yet where they want to go, the lines of the future that they'd like to devise for themselves. Equality, by all means, but what's needed beyond equality, as the Israel experience makes abundantly clear, is a new vision of woman, perhaps a new vision of humanity, of people, one which will allow the woman to be something more than an aggressive predator, which has been the male image, one which will allow perhaps all of us to become something more than aggressive and callous and demanding. One which will remove certain burdens and yet allow us to be competent. That image has not yet been struck. No man would dare to suggest what its lines should be. Even a rabbi has limits to his public valor. But that image must be found. That image must be found. Because all of us, men and women, need in these difficult, confused times to have an image of self-worth, a model, a goal, standards, which seem appropriate and meaningful, which allow us to do what must be done and to become the kinds of people that we ought to be. I suspect that one of the reasons that we still can be moved by the Eshet Chayil, the Woman of Valor poem, is that it speaks of things which are patently and obviously worth the doing in a given social context. Many of these things still need to be done. What needs to be done? What ideal of human personality can we evolve, which has grace and dignity and meaning? If some of you will, if any one of you will write an Eshet Chayil poem for 1974, the world will bless you, and I will see to it that it's added on to the scroll of the Book of Proverbs in the Bible, and we will revolutionize in a nice way all of modern life. The challenge is there. God willing, someone will find the words, and all of us will find the way. Amen.